From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, open lines for you. Here's what's happening. A string of Donald Trump primary victories Tuesday night, including a knockout win against Marco Rubio in Florida. He's dropped out, as well as a first win by John Kasich in his home state of Ohio, did little to change the direction of the Republican presidential race, except to add a little more uncertainty and speculation. Trump kept his substantial delegate lead by winning at least three contests and defeating Rubio in the senator's home state of Florida and pushing him out of the race. Trump won the biggest prize on the map, including all 99 of its delegates. He also is projected to win in Illinois and in North Carolina. And in Missouri, it's too close to call there. Now, on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton further cemented her lead. She defeated Bernie Sanders in the hard-fought Ohio primary, as well as North Carolina and Florida, completing her sweep of the Southern state contest. Again, Missouri there is too close to call, but she is inching ahead there. Let's check in with two experts and get their take on all of this. First of all, Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. Any surprises here for you, John?
I think Missouri certainly is a squeaker, but I mean, it is 100% now. Trump has won the Missouri primary. That's a brand new result. All the votes are counted. He's won by 0.1%.
Oh my God, that's close.
Yeah, very close. 1,600 votes separated them. Not as close as Bush v. Gore.
Well, and the big thing there in Missouri, what he gets by winning is he'll get 12 delegates, and then they go to the congressional districts. There's eight of them there, and then he's winning most of those, too.
Well, let's put it this way. Look, Kasich, you know, put in major press and won Ohio, his only state. And now Kasich is beating, you know, pounding the chest, saying he is now the front. He's like he's the front runner right now. He's won one primary, and his delegate count is at 138. That's 30 below Marco Rubio, who's already dropped out. Trump is well ahead, almost doubling, you know, Cruz right now in the delegate count. And the movement forward, George, and I've looked at this very carefully. We're talking about the remaining delegate-rich states all favor Trump. A few scattered states here or there for Cruz, but most of the delegate-rich states Trump is going to clean up in. So I think, you know, Kasich hanging around can only be for one reason, and that is he's now the last ditch anti-Trump candidate of the Republican establishment trying to prevent him from, you know, that magic number of 1237 so that they can go to a contested or a brokered convention and somebody can decide this in some smoke-filled, room or something. But it's very clear that Kasich should, I mean, clearly drop out of this. He has no possible mathematical path to the nomination. Rubio is out, beaten almost by 20% by Trump in Florida,
his home state.
And I don't know if you recall last week, Rubio was absolutely guaranteeing a victory. He sounded like Baghdad Bob, you know, talking about the U.S. being routed in Iraq when, you know, the statue of Saddam Hussein was falling off. So I think what you're looking at right now is dirty, really dirty tactics by hangovers for the Republican establishment, still not getting on, you know, behind Trump. And now there's some talk of, you know, by some conservatives of if Trump wins the nomination, that they'll run a third-party conservative candidate against him and hand the election to Hillary.
Well, that's what it would do.
That really helps things.
Now, let me ask you a quick question about Ted Cruz, who I still think is going to be somewhat close. I'm still holding back that this could be a brokered convention, John. But the Rubio delegates, there's not a lot, and Kasich delegates, if they both drop out, can they assign them to Ted Cruz if they wanted to? Or are they up for grabs? I don't know how that works.
No, they can't just hand their delegates over. Those delegates go to the convention, and then at the convention they can decide where they're going because their candidate is no longer there, but not before then. But I think what we're looking at right now is Trump in a formidable lead against Cruz. With Cruz, I don't know if you heard his speech tonight to his supporters.
I did.
But it was almost like it was a winning speech. Like there's, you know, a silver lining to losing all five primaries tonight for Cruz. And I called it last week. I said it's very doubtful that he'll win any. And I'm telling you, going forward, Cruz has very little shot in the delegate-rich states in the upper Midwest, the Northeast, and in the West.
Hey, they're all going to have a tough time against Hillary, though. I'm telling you, they're going to have a tough time against her.
Well, I think, look, Hillary is a formidable candidate. Everybody knew that. We knew that, you know, 2 years ago when, you know, the Benghazi committee was formed. I mean, they've hit her with everything but the kitchen sink, short of an indictment or at least an FBI recommendation of an indictment. I think that she essentially sails through this. Between you and I think that it's like a snowball's chance and you know where for Loretta Lynch to take any recommendation to prosecute Hillary for anything. So I think that she's going to survive the email scandal, the Benghazi scandal, and the final report that's due out in June. But I still think that a Trump candidacy has the potential for mobilizing massive amounts of independent voters. And those independents and some of those Reagan Democrats are not happy with Hillary's position backing, rubber stamping, essentially, Saudi Arabia in that Syrian proxy war against Bashar Assad, and among other things. So I don't think it's a slam dunk for Hillary going into the fall against a candidate like Trump.
All right, John, we'll talk to you soon, my friend. And then, of course, Howard Bloom, the expert, the genius of the beast, he's with us. Howard, your take on tonight?
Well, this is, let's go into the background. What you were just discussing was the numbers and how they're going to stack up.
Yeah.
The bottom line is that this election is a revolt against the billionaires. It's a revolt against the super rich owning our politicians. Now, that would seem a silly statement. It's one that you and I could agree on, but a Rasmussen poll just came out. Rasmussen is a Republican polling organization, and it shows something really surprising. 61% of Americans say that candidates listen to big contributors, not to voters. Well, that fact is obvious to you and me, but it has never been obvious to the American populace in the way that it is now. Meanwhile, the voters want things that are utterly surprising. They want government regulation of campaign contributions. Even more than that, they want to publish the names of all the donors, transparency. This is a rebellion against Citizens United, you know, the Supreme Court decision that made a corporation a person and allowed these persons free speech. Now, 66% feel the federal government has become a special interest group that looks out primarily for its own interests. But in what this all comes down to in the Rasmussen poll is this is a revolt to restore the government to the people, a government of the people, for the people, and by the people. And the bottom line, in addition, is that Trump is sweeping out the old Republican billionaire formula, the
yes.
old conservative formula.
Out they go.
That you remove taxes and regulation from the super rich, and guess what? We all get rich. Well, we've been doing that for 30 or 40 years, and we've all seen our wages stagnate. It's not working. The traditional conservative approach is clamped down on unions, teachers, the poor, get rid of Social Security, Medicaid, welfare, and spending for infrastructure, and we'll all be rich. It hasn't worked. And Trump is just taking that cliche, and he's tossing it out with the morning trash. And Bernie Sanders, which makes Bernie Sanders, is in all of our conversations, and Donald Trump, strange allies, because Donald Trump, the billionaire, and Bernie Sanders, the anti-billionaire, are both taking aim at the billionaire class. And Bernie, who, by the way, has won quite a few states up until now and will probably win Missouri tonight.
No, I think Bernie, Hillary's going to beat him, believe it or not.
Well, Hillary is going to beat him. There's no question.
She's going to beat him in Missouri tonight because the St. Louis vote, Howard, hasn't come in yet. That is African-American, and most of them are going to side with Hillary.
Well, that's your home territory.
So I know that like the back of my hand. Yeah.
Oh, yes. But the point is that Bernie's full court press has forced Hillary to say She said this in one of her acceptance speeches tonight. We are not going to stand up for American, or we are going to stand up for American workers and make sure no one takes advantage of us, not China, not Wall Street, not overpaid corporate executives. And this is the first time she's made that kind of statement, and it's thanks to a full court press, not just from Bernie Sanders, but from, of all people, the billionaire Donald Trump.
When this all unfolds, Mr. Bloom, let's get together again and talk about all of this. Howard Bloom, by the way. All right, people who want to quit smoking are more likely to succeed if they simply go cold turkey by stopping abruptly, according to a study. Volunteers who use this approach were 25% more likely to remain abstinent half a year from the date that they give up smoking than those who gradually tried to wean themselves off. Former astronaut Buzz Aldrin is eyeing 2040 for the first manned mission to Mars, noting that the red planet's moon Phobos could play a vital role for astronauts. He said by 2040, he explains that astronauts could have visited Mars' moon as a stepping stone to Mars. And he's all excited about that. Purina has issued a voluntary recall of their tubs of wet dog food. According to the company, some of the 10-ounce tubs of the wet dog food do not contain the recommended levels of vitamins and minerals. The recall includes the Beneful prepared meals, the Beneful chopped blends, and the ProPlan savory meal brands of food. Purina suggests that you throw out the products. Listen to this story out of North Korea. One of North Korea's top aides, has been purged because his son broke the law. What did the son do? He was caught watching a South Korean television soap opera. That is forbidden in North Korea. He was caught by the state security department. I guess they monitor whatever they watch. Well, the top North Korean leader had to volunteer himself into re-education and apologized to Kim Jong-un, saying that he poorly educated his children. Unbelievable there. Michael Jackson's estate has agreed to sell its remaining stake in a lucrative music catalog to Sony, $750 million. Get ready for more Indiana Jones. Disney has announced its plans to release the fifth Indiana Jones movie starring Harrison Ford, coming out in 2019. Steven Spielberg will return as the film's director. The first Indiana Jones film, Raiders of the Lost Ark, released in 1981. Wow, huh? Has time flown by. You know, New York City's murder rate soared 10% last year. Chicago, the homicide toll climbed 19%. Baltimore, New Orleans, St. Louis, the rate has skyrocketed by 33%. In Milwaukee, the murder rate has doubled. What's going on? Up next, Barry Latzer joins me. The rise and fall of violent crime in America on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Let me tell you about our special guest for the first couple hours here. He's the author of The Rise and Fall of Violent Crime in America, Barry Latzer, renowned criminologist, author of this incredible book. He is also the professor emeritus at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He has written extensively on violent crime, capital punishment, criminal procedure law. Barry served as an assistant district attorney in Brooklyn, as an appellate counsel for indigent criminal defendants in the Big Apple. He received his JD degree from Fordham University, his PhD in political science from the University of Massachusetts, and here he is on Coast to Coast. Barry, good to have you with us.
Thank you, George. Good to be with you.
Violent crime, I was reading these statistics, out of sight. What's going on?
Well, we don't want to get too alarmist now, George. We have a spike in 1 year's figures in some cities. So criminologists don't want to jump off the bridge over this yet. We need a multi-year trend before we could say that we have a real rise in crime, a more ominous rise in crime. Certainly, there are some alarm bells here. There's some red flags. But we need that trend before we could say for sure that we're in for trouble.
And Barry, when we talk about violent crime, obviously we're talking about murders, but what else is tossed into that?
Right. So the FBI and criminologists generally agree on this.
They include assaults, especially aggravated assault. That means where you have serious bodily injury. You could think of that crime as sort of a murder that didn't quite make it, a failed murder. The next crime included would be a rape. And the fourth crime is robbery, which is a hybrid of a violent crime and a property crime, because you have to use force or threaten the use of force under the definitions used in the United States, but you also have to have theft of property. So that's a hybrid crime. So those are the four. You could throw in the mix a couple of other crimes, George, like kidnapping, for instance. But this happens so infrequently that the criminologists, the FBI, don't pay much attention to it. So those are the big four.
Barry, tell me about the title, because that's the crux of everything we're talking about tonight, the rise and the fall of violent crime in America.
Well, this is what intrigued me when I started this project. I wanted to know, well, why is it that crime rates soared and went so high that I was listening to your broadcast discussing the political issues of the day. I can assure you that from the late 1960s to the early 1990s, there would have been really one overwhelming issue, and that would have been violent crime.
Yeah.
So I was interested in why it was that violent crime rose so much and why it fell so rapidly. The rise, by the way, just put some numbers on this for you. If you look at 1960 violent crime rates, those crimes we were talking about earlier, and then you look at 1990 rates, you see a rise of 353%. Now that is a scary number.
It sure is.
So I was interested in the historical background, the setting for the rise in crime, for the fall in crime. And actually, the book goes back to World War II. It goes back to the 1940s, because sometimes to really understand a situation, you have to look at what happened beforehand, how the historical progression, if you will, of the phenomenon. So I went back to the 1940s, and indeed my research goes back even earlier than that, back to the 19th century, but this book is primarily focused on the post-World War II period.
We just talked, I spent a lot of time, Barry, in St. Louis, and we were talking about how crime there has skyrocketed, violent crime. Now, years ago, there were some areas in St. Louis you could freely walk by at night, you know, didn't have to worry about anything. Nowadays, I wouldn't go there unless I'm carrying my concealed weapon, to be honest with you. What's happening in some areas of the country where it's high and other places it's not?
Yes, and this is, of course, this could be a local phenomenon going on. For instance, you could have gangs in an area,
yeah,
youth gangs. You could have a drug problem in an area and not have it in another area. There's also what we call a contagion phenomenon that sometimes takes hold. Contagions are where people's behavior is copied by other people. And this is especially true with young people because they're very susceptible to the influence of their peers. So to take something benign, you could see this with fashion, for instance. Suddenly, young males are all wearing these trousers that are coming down nearly to their knees, right? Now, 20 years ago, this wasn't happening, but it became a fad. It was copied, and it became widespread, even though it's kind of uncomfortable. I mean, I wouldn't walk around that way myself. I'm an old cut.
I'm with you.
Don't go by me. But the point is, youth copy one another, and violent crime can be a contagion, so that if other guys are doing it, engaging in assaults
and bragging about
robberies and boasting about it, that's helpful actually to promoting the contagion. So this, if you have this contagion effect, this could mushroom in an area of a city and not affect other parts of the city right away.
Good point. Barry, hold on. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and talk more about your work and research, the rise and fall of violent crime in America. Next hour, we're going to take your calls with Barry, and perhaps you've been a victim. You might want to share that story, too. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Barry Latzer with us tonight for a couple hours, the rise and fall of violent crime in America. As we look at just what's happening in the future, Barry, going forward, how do you see violent crime? Is it continue to, you know, waver up and down in certain areas, or are we going to have a plunge? The FBI generally says things are getting better.
Well, when I look at the current situation, I look back in history and see if the factors that led to the crime rise, the massive crime rise that began in the late 60s, are present today. Now, history doesn't always repeat itself, so this may turn out to be an erroneous analysis, but here is where we stand. Back in the late 60s, you had a big factor was demographics that influenced the rise of crime. The baby boom generation, so-called, consisted of mostly young men coming home from World War II and coming into a booming economy and deciding to have families. Their children came of age for crime, that is, between 18 and 25, in the late 1960s. So this baby boom generation was the generation responsible for the massive rise in violent crime. Now, whenever you get a bulge, especially of young males reaching those ages, 18 to 25, that's not a guarantee, but it's a red flag for violent crime. So that's the first factor I looked at. And where do we stand, George? Essentially, we're in good shape. The society is, in fact, aging. There's no sign of a big increase in this age cohort, this 18 to 25 cohort. And so, from a demographic perspective, things look good. I don't see a sign of a big rise in crime.
What are we doing in terms of giving some of these young people, Barry, hope so they can look forward to some kind of future where they don't have to turn to crime?
Well, I wish that hope alone was sufficient to deter people. Of course, people who are hopeful, I suppose, are less likely to engage in crime. But when people engage in violent crime, it's often, George, as a result of some dispute or conflict or argument, sometimes with people they love, sometimes with friends and neighbors. And so I'm not sure that just hopefulness about the future is sufficient to make people less violent. They seem to engage in violence mainly with people they know. And so I think being optimistic and hopeful might correlate with less violent activity, but it might not. There seem to be other factors involved. Impulsiveness, for instance, a tendency to fly off the handle. The ready availability of weapons certainly is a factor that leads to more serious assaults and murders.
What would happen, Barry, if they legalized all drugs? Just made them all legal. Do you think crime would continue to drop?
I don't. I'm afraid it would be helpful in this respect. The criminal gangs that distribute illegal drugs, which under your suggestion would now become legal, would of course not have much business anymore. But on the other hand, There would be, as long as you have people without much money and maybe without much hope, to use the word you used in the conversation a minute or two ago, as long as you have people who become addicted to drugs and don't have the means to support their habits, they will engage in criminal behavior in order to acquire the means to support their drug habits. So as long as they have to engage in crime, then drugs will contribute to crime. So I think we would still have a crime problem. And then, of course, you have this other issue, and that is, even if the drugs were to be legalized, you're not going to legalize the distribution to children. You're not going to legalize the distribution to underage people. So drugs will still have to be policed. The distribution of drugs will still have to be regulated, just as we regulate the distribution of alcohol, which is legal but only above a certain age. So I don't say it would be the same drug problem. Wouldn't be the same drug problem. It would be different, but nonetheless, it wouldn't resolve all of our issues. And in the short run, my concern is, if something is legalized, it will encourage greater use. And with serious narcotic drugs, that would mean more addiction.
Historically, certain ethnic groups would either commit crimes or not commit crimes. And as you have looked at ethnic groups that you would also call social groups going way back, why is it that some groups, distinctive groups, social economic groups, ethnic groups, would not commit severe violent crimes as much as other ethnic groups? Why that diversity?
Well, this is one of the most interesting findings in my work. And I need to set the background of this a bit.
Okay.
The first thing I would point out, of course, is we're not making any racial or ethnic generalization that's biological or genetic. This is not a matter of something that's transmitted down from generation to generation in any biological sense. So this is what we call a cultural manifestation. That is, this is a matter of beliefs and values held by different groups of people, including a belief or a value in using violence to resolve interpersonal conflict. And this is the key to understanding the different violent crime rates of different social groups. So when a group, a distinctive group, and it could be regional, it could be racial, it could be ethnic, it could be religious, when a distinctive group has a propensity, because of their beliefs and their values, to use violence to resolve interpersonal conflict, they will have higher rates of assault and higher rates of homicide. And this is what we mean when we refer to the differentials between ethnic and racial and religious groups. So with that as the background, what did I find? I found that some groups throughout history, immigrant groups, or in the case of African Americans, migrant groups within the United States, have had very high rates of interpersonal violence. And when these groups are at their point of origin, you can see that they have high homicide rates. These are measurable. We can determine this. And when these same groups migrate or immigrate to the United States, they transmit their high interpersonal violence rates. They transport, I should say, their high interpersonal violence rates with them. So that, let's take an example. In the mid-19th century, to go way back in history, the Irish who came to the United States in the 1840s, 1850s, because of the Great Potato Famine in Ireland, had high rates of interpersonal violence and transport. imported those rates to the United States, so that for many decades, Irish in the United States had very high rates of interpersonal violence. And this was also true in the early 20th century, late 19th century for Chinese immigrants to the west coast of the United States. It was also true for immigrants from southern Italy who came mostly to New York between 1900 and 1910. And as we go throughout American history, we see that different groups have had these high rates of interpersonal violence. And those rates, as I say, were transported with the group when they immigrated to the U.S. or migrated within the U.S. And one last point before we continue, some immigrant groups and some migrant groups have had low rates of interpersonal violence. So today, for instance, immigrants from Asia, as we call it, from Japan, from China, from other countries in Asia, generally have low rates of interpersonal violence. And those low rates are also transported with these groups. So that we're not really making a generalization about all immigrants. We are saying that there are differentials in terms of violent crime between groups. It depends on the culture of the group.
And I mean, there's no question that in the 20s, for example, the mafia was built primarily with ethnic Italians.
That's correct.
There's no doubt about that.
That's correct.
Is that something they carried with them from Italy?
Well, there definitely was a mafia in Italy, although it took different form in the United States. There was another a group that controlled economic activities in Italy called the Camorra, and it was similar to the mafia in the United States. And so, yes, this too was a cultural manifestation. But in fact, the violent crime of the southern Italian migrants was, and this is true for almost all of these groups, was almost all intramural. That is, it was Italian on Italian crime. As I said earlier, when you have violence between friends, loved ones, neighbors, coworkers, they're usually from the same background. They're usually the same ethnic group, because people who have the same background tend to live together. So the Italians who were involved in organized crime during the 1920s also had high rates of interpersonal violence even before the 1920s. But Prohibition gave them a new opportunity, of course, to make a great deal of money on a very popular substance, namely alcohol.
And today we see problems with illegal immigrants who have come in, some of them, not all of them, of course, where, you know, they've been convicted of violent crimes, of murders. I just had a story yesterday that 124 that were released went on to commit 134 murders. I mean, unbelievable statistics.
Right. And of course, in Mexico, there are high rates of violent crime. And once again, this is a group that will tend to transport their high rates when they migrate to the United States. Now, I need to add one more consideration into this, George, that's also important. When a group, which whatever their background, moves up to the middle class, when a group starts obtaining middle-class values and reflecting middle-class values, then they usually do not resort to violence and therefore do not engage in violent crime. So we saw this with Irish when they came to the United States. We saw this with the Italians when they came to the United States. We're seeing this today with African Americans who, of course, have lived in the United States for centuries. When a group moves up to the middle class, if that group has had high rates of interpersonal violence, those rates will decline dramatically. And that's because middle class people don't do a lot of violence, because to do violence, if you're in the middle class, you risk everything. You risk your family, your job, your friends, right, your reputation. But young and low income males who have nothing to lose might well engage in violence. There are no real disincentives for them to do so.
Is that what go ahead, Barry. I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. I was just going to say, so when a group, whatever the nature of the group, has high rates of interpersonal violence, it's usually when they're in the what we call low socioeconomic mm-hmm. status category. That is, they're poor, to use a much simpler word. They're poor, and they have these high rates of interpersonal violence. But when they move up to the middle class, when they have the opportunities to advance, which this country affords them, and they move to the middle class, then they shed those interpersonal violence values, and then we find their crime rates plummet.
Is that what we're seeing in the Middle East with members of ISIS, for example, who are primarily younger people, probably in their 20s and 30s, who obviously don't have much going on for themselves? They're getting some money now. They're being paid as these mercenaries and soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a good example of this?
No, because, I mean, it's a good example in that they're young and, of course,
poor,
can be and can be attracted to more extreme behavior. But here's the difference with those folks. These people are ideologically driven. They're driven by an idea. It may be a terrible evil idea, but they're driven by ideas, and ideas can be tremendously powerful motivators, of course. And if they're bad ideas, if they're evil ideas, well, then, of course, evil will come out of that motivation. So that's the difference. Most violent crime is not ideologically driven. It's just driven, as I say, by disputes and quarrels among people. Petty things drive those crimes. But folks like ISIS, people like terrorists within the United States, the San Bernardino shooters, for instance, they're motivated by ideology. They're motivated by an idea.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the idea, as I say, may be a terrible one. It may be an evil one. But it's such a strong motivator that they're willing to engage in violence and even murder what they perceive to be their enemy.
Or kill themselves in the pursuit of that.
That's right.
All right,
been murdered themselves.
We're going to come back. We're at the top of the hour. We're going to come back and talk more about your work, The Rise and Fall of Violent Crime in America. And, of course, we're going to take your phone calls as well on Coast to Coast AM. So don't touch your dial. We'll be right back.